Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
All right. Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Maybe finally no longer at death's door, which is an improvement.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends who are alive.
Yeah, that's a bonus. as always, thank you to the folks who are listening on Tuesday. You're helping to keep this thing afloat and giving us reasons to expand with things like the Odyssey Book Club, which I think people are enjoying. People seem to be enjoying. Like, seriously, if you read the I was reading the last book that we did after I had read Alyssa's piece. I was running behind. A lot of things happening this week in the world of entertainment. And then I started reading it in John Bernthal's like mid-Atlantic accent. And I was like, oh, this is a million times better. This is how he should do it in the movie. I hope this is what Christopher Nolan told him to do. So we'll see. We'll see how it is. All right. And now on to controversies and non-controversies. So Paramount Skydance has somewhat unexpectedly succeeded in its hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers, beating out Netflix. There are a lot of different angles here, and one we've covered before several times, and therefore I don't think we really need to hit on again too hard, are the efforts by Trump and his allies, the Ellisons, to kind of rig the regulatory process here in Paramount Skydance's favor to tell people were telling Netflix it's going to take you years and years to get through this. We're going to shoot you down. The Republican attorney generals were saying we're not going to sign off on this, et cetera, et cetera. We all agree this is bad and out of the norm and shouldn't have happened. There's an antitrust regulatory argument to be made on kind of both sides here. And the way this played out was I think bad. I think we all kind of agree on that. So we're gonna just say controversy. That's controversy. We're gonna focus on what this means really for the rest of the entertainment industry, right? So okay, this is a $110 billion deal. It does the following things. It brings Paramount and Warner Brothers, two of the original major studios, under the same roof. That's the first thing. Over the last 30 years, these two distributors have combined for about 25% of the domestic box office gross. Warner Brothers is the second biggest distributor. Paramount is the fifth. The biggest threat to the film industry is a very simple one. Paramount isn't going to want to compete against itself, which means that despite whatever they're saying right now, and they're saying also, oh, we're going to keep doing 40 movies a year and there's not going to be any decrease in output, they are going to wind up releasing fewer movies. We know this because we've seen it happen before with the Fox-Disney merger. Those two studios have combined to release about 50% fewer films than they did separately before the merger. And look, there are other things involved here, the rise of streaming, COVID, et cetera. But the simple fact of the matter is that 20th Century Studios and Disney and their various little, you know, independent labels, they release fewer films wide than they did before the merger. Bad for movie theaters, which rely on a constant flow of films. It's bad for filmmakers who now have one fewer buyer. It's bad for audiences who get fewer films. That all around is not great. The cable part of this is kind of interesting because the second part of this deal is that Paramount will now control an enormous number of cable channels from the MTVs and the TBSs and the TNTs of the world. And those channels throw off an enormous amount of revenue still via affiliate fees. Now, this business is in terminal decline. I think this is the thing that all of these companies are kind of struggling with right now is what are we going to do with these massive cable companies that still make a lot of money, but we're not sure what to do with them. The real question is how much juice can Paramount kind of squeeze from this dying fruit? What happens to CNN is another question entirely. Does it come under the purview of CBS News? Does it merge with them maybe? What do the Ellisons think can be done with this asset? I was listening to Matt Bellany's show, The Town. He had an emergency podcast with Lucas Shaw, and there their solution was to turn it into like the CNN version of Ridiculousness. You know how MTV just has the show Ridiculousness on all the time? Well, you just do that, but with like Stanley Tucci's cooking show. You just have like 17 hours of Stanley Tucci cooking every day on CNN. Sure, that makes sense.
That and then periodically and then regime change in Iran. Like, we break into this episode of Stanley Tucci talking about bolognese sauce to let you know.
I bet Tucci does better ratings, frankly. Then there's the streaming element. Theoretically, the two companies have a combined 210 million streaming customers. Now, in practice, a lot of those people probably subscribe to both. There's some overlap. I know I am one of those people, for instance. I subscribe to both Paramount Plus and HBO Max. Again, theoretically, combining these two services could be good for people like me. You put them together, they should be cheaper, right? Two channels, why? The redundancies, it should make everything more affordable. I'm sure I will get screwed in this situation. I'm 100% chance I end up spending more money for both of these somehow. Regardless, the combined company is not bigger than Netflix. I still don't really understand who thinks they're going to be competing with Netflix. If you look at the numbers, they're not even close to Netflix size when you combine them. It's like this is the least troubling part of the whole merger, as far as I'm concerned. It's going to be smaller than Netflix. It'll be smaller than YouTube, smaller than Disney Plus. Like, it makes them more competitive on that ground, and therefore seems more or less fine. Look, bottom line here is that Netflix and Paramount were both bad options, in my opinion, in terms of who could have bought Warner Brothers, just for different reasons. Maybe this deal winds up working out for everybody. Maybe nobody loses their jobs, and we still get all even more content than before. In reality, it's going to mean redundancies, which is to say layoffs and mass firings. It's going to mean fewer films produced. It's going to mean probably lead to more theater closures. It's probably going to mean fewer choices in streaming. It's going to mean crappier cable networks. Seems bad all around, question mark. I don't know, Peter. I'm being the negative Nancy here. You be a positive Peter. Positive Peter, what's the bright side of this deal?
Well, I just want to go back to when we first talked about this a couple of months ago, and the conversation ended with us sort of all kind of discussing which buyer we would prefer to win this. And I said that I ultimately preferred Netflix, understanding that there were some downsides there. It's not like I thought Netflix was wholly good and there was nothing bad about it, in part because Netflix was sort of building a studio to compete with YouTube, which is, I think, the real long-term threat. And the other thing is, as part of that, is that they were capitalized, and that allowed them to kind of take on this level of debt that Warner Brothers has in a way that was going to be easier for their business. And what you're going to see here from Paramount is that there are going to be job cuts. There are going to be spending reductions. If I want to make a positive case for that, they may not be as big as some people are predicting. Ted Sarandos, in an interview with Lucas Shaw, said that it was going to be something like $16 billion, I think, was the number that he said that they needed to cut. Other places have said it's maybe more like $6 or $7 billion, right? So, but these are big numbers, no matter how you look at them. At the same time, you know, if you're going to oppose those cuts, or you're going to say, well, that's awful. I mean, sure, in many cases, they're going to represent people's jobs, and that's rough. And there's no way to get around that. But if you're going to oppose those cuts, you have to say that absolutely every single thing that Paramount and Warner Brothers were doing was worth doing. And it may well be that a combined entity can do the things that are worth doing and cut out some things that weren't working, and that efficiency can be good, and efficiency and sort of finding efficiencies of scale can be good, not for both for commerce and for art here. And I think they may have an opportunity that I have not seen Warner Brothers pursue at the level Warner Brothers' strategy with DC Comics in particular, and then also with Harry Potter, has really kind of baffled me over the last decade. I mean, there was the Snyderverse with the DC Comics, which I think, you know, just obviously sort of fizzled out and didn't work, even if you liked the Snyder Cut. You know, but there were a bunch of movies there that were big disasters. The second Harry Potter series, they basically just canceled in the middle because it was such a freaking disaster. Nobody saw those I can't remember what
Fantastic
they were called.
Fantastic
Beasts, right? There's literally, they're so forgettable that I cannot remember the name of the franchise, even though I definitely saw the first two of them in movie theaters. Right. And that's just like crappy brand management I'm not going to say it's definitely going to be better, but this is an opportunity to kind of renew that stuff. The DC renewal under James Gunn does seem like it's going reasonably well in certain ways, but I think there's been a big missed opportunity for DC Comics outside of big theatrical tent poles. There just doesn't seem like there is nearly enough content that is relatively inexpensive and aimed at kids. And this is something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, is Batman is obviously sort of the biggest character in the DC universe. Superman is also very big, but then you have this whole other, you know, universe. And Marvel, you know, whatever its troubles today, did really well in the 2010s, spinning out a universe that had based on a bunch of B characters, not their A characters. I mean, we forget, like, Iron Man was not considered an essential, you know, main part of the universe when they made the first Iron Man film back in the 2007, I believe it was. And so there's all these other characters, but there's also this opportunity to do stuff that's less expensive and brings kids in. And they, in fact, it's not just an opportunity. I think it's a necessity, because the reason that Batman is a billion-dollar franchise is that Batman has been building fans. Let's just say it's going to be mostly men, right? And you start them as young boys, and you get them when they're 8, and you become a Batman fan when you're 8 years old, and then for the rest of your life, you kind of pay a Batman fee every year. You spend somewhere between $25 and $100 on some Batman stuff, some t-shirts, some movie tickets, some comic books. Maybe it's a lot more than that. I can see Sonny doing some Batman cash math in his head right now. I mean, like, I've got, you know, just a few feet from where I'm sitting, I have got a giant shelf full of Batman comic books, all of which I bought in my 20s, maybe even into my very early 30s. All right. There's just a lot of Batman stuff in my, but nobody becomes a Batman fan at the age of 30. No. And the kids stuff that they are putting out right now is sparse, and I don't think it's working nearly well enough. And so this might be an opportunity to sort of rebuild the kid part, you know, the sort of kid part of the funnel for not just Batman specifically, though I think Batman is a big part of it, but for the entire DC Comics universe, which needs to go back and rebuild, you know, for young boys, for age 5 to 15, that is when you catch them and make them Batman fans for life. And they haven't done this nearly as well as I think they should have over the past decade. They've mostly been catering to 30-somethings who are like, maybe Batman should be R-rated and really dark and murder people sometimes. No, he's for kids. And it's fine sometimes for him to be for 30-year-olds,
too. Tim Burton Batman blew up like 30 people in that chemical factory.
I am not...
bombs that were attached to his toy car that all the kids had.
I'm sorry. Your answer here is very interesting to me, because on the one hand, I'm like, tens of thousands of people will lose their jobs and will probably lose more theaters and... You know, I think competition will be decreased. And your response is, yes, but they might be better at Batman, which I don't know how to respond to that, Peter.
So I'll just remind you. I actually want to hear Alyssa here, but I will just remind you that both you and James Cameron said that Netflix can't win this deal because it will be worse for theatrical. And I don't think there is an alternative here to Warner Brothers being bought. Warner Brothers is either going to be owned by Paramount or owned by Netflix. And so if the question is, like, what is this going to be bad for theatrical? It's going to be less bad in the near term than Netflix own in the near to medium term. Let's say the 3 to 8 year timeline, though it's the future is so hard to tell right now. Like it is. I do think that Netflix, even though I in some ways was more supportive of Netflix, looked to me like they were preparing to to really kind of just not kill theatrical, but just ignore theatrical starting about 5 years after the purchase.
Yeah. I mean, look, again, you're right. I'm by no means somebody who's sitting here and saying Netflix had to own this, because I didn't really want Netflix to own it either. Maybe this can all work out and the regulatory process will end up killing this anyway. I don't know. Alyssa, what's your takeaway from this deal?
I think it's a lot of questions, right? I mean, it is, I think, important to remember that Skydance is a small snake that has just swallowed two elephants and is going to have to digest them, right? I mean, it is a very small entity that, backed by daddy's money, was able to buy two very expensive things, some of which had debt, and to load them up with more debt really quickly. And I think what happens after the snake's digestive juices have done its work really remains to be seen, right? I mean, sorry, I'm torturing this metaphor and torturing Sunny with it. But look, you know, David Ellison has not run an organization as big as one of these organizations ever. And now he's going to be running an organization that's some combination of the two of them plus his own little thing. And when you both have to deal with a lot of debt very quickly and a bunch of redundancy, and you don't have a lot of management experience, you aren't necessarily going to make the best decisions long term, right? You, in part because there's just going to be a lot of stuff that you don't know and you sort of have to guess at. And I think it's just very up in the air what will happen. You know, we've talked a lot about the entertainment properties, but like what happens with CNN and CBS, right? Combining the two of them, I think, is complicated because CBS is unionized, CNN is not. But, you know, I am not. It's going to be interesting to see what they cut and what they keep, sort of as a sign of what they think is likely to be successful. But they're going to make some of these decisions before they actually know. And so I think we're just entering a period of extreme uncertainty and volatility. I think that the guess that everything will end up being smaller, that there will be fewer choices, is obviously correct. But it's not like David Ellison has like a long and extremely venerable track record of either making a lot of different kinds of movies or running television news networks. And we just don't know what that's going to look like, right? This is going to be a real sort of trial by fire situation.
Skydance part of this is interesting. And you're right. I think you're right to hit on it, because if you look at the sort of stuff that Skydance has made, it's interesting. It is like he's making a lot of kind of classic, high concept, tentpole, and also franchise stuff. Like that is what Skydance has really, has really kind of zeroed in on. And they have been making this for largely for Apple, but like also, you know, there's been some theatrical stuff and elsewhere. And like some of it is kind of hit. I know the Family Plan, which Skydance produced, is considered a pretty big success for Apple, to the extent that they like almost immediately greenlit a sequel and were rushing that out the door. You know, but a lot of it hasn't quite worked. You know, a lot of it has kind of missed. And if you're looking at people, organizations that could be stewards of Warner Brothers, I don't think Skydance is actually the worst option here. I think Ellison has at least some kind of concept of what big budget tentpole filmmaking should look like.
Sure.
And I think he's got some idea of how to use IP, but I also like, I just look at how much stuff they're going to have under their tent now and be like, how is he not going to get overwhelmed by this?
Two things about One is, isn't the story about his sort of film fandom like highly tied up specifically in going to see Terminator 2 when he was about 10 years old, I believe with his dad, but I could be messing up that part of the story. And then I also recall, I don't have it in front of me, and I this could be a hallucination, but I also recall that part of what he has said publicly in the last couple of months is that if they won this deal, they wanted to make down the line popular blockbusters, and the like. There was an implication that it was going to be with an action bent. We're going to make stuff that works for big audiences, was what he basically said he wanted to do with the combined Paramount Warner Brothers unit. And I think that I mean, he wants to make stuff that is popular and makes money and is kind of actiony and has a little bit, you know, and fun. And that does not seem like a crazy thing for especially a young, he's in his early 40s, a young studio chief to want to do. But like Alyssa's totally right. We have no idea how this is going to play out. And one thing is, even if he's reasonably successful with some of these films and makes some hits, the debt situation here and just kind of the overall finances combined with the fact that linear cable, despite all this revenue, is a declining business. And there is no way that is changing. It is going to decline until it dies. That means, I think, that it is definitely possible that in 5 years or 10 years or 12 years, this is all back on the block. And maybe Netflix picks it up for a song later.
Right. But I think the combination of the debt load and the perception that the deal is politically tainted, that he's kind of a neophyte who bought these studios with daddy's money, just creates a complicated talent management situation, right? Because like, I don't think he's going to be able to, for example, give Martin Scorsese $200 million to make a passion project. And so he's going to have to rely on sort of charm and personal credibility. And that remains just a big, he shouldn't actually give Martin Scorsese $200 million to make another Killers of the Flower Moon, right? Like, nobody should do that. But I think
he needs $200 million to make Kool-Aid.
Right.
I'm going to have to disagree with you. I know zero filmmakers who, if Satan himself showed up on their doorstep with the blank check, said, make your passion project.
Right.
They would
but,
say
he's
no.
not, but he's not. But he's not going to have the blank checks. Right. And so it is harder to be a neophyte, like a relative neophyte who needs to lock down talent and not have, you know, bad stories coming out when you also have a really tight debt situation, right? I just think that is a challenging management situation to be someone who is, you know, younger, politically controversial, and unable to just buy people's, you know, first experience with him, right? I think that's a hard management situation. And you know, maybe he's the most talented visionary guy in the world. It's just hard. I mean, I like the movies that his sister made a lot more than the ones that he's made in general. But again, I think this is just like, he's a relatively small snake and those are some pretty big elephants. And like,
I mean, I do think it is hard. It is probably worth mentioning that Annapurna which is the company that Megan Ellison, his sister, founded, that made a lot of movies that we all like, Annapurna Pictures, very successful at aiming at a very niche, highbrow audience. Her company is functionally defunct.
Yep.
And his company just bought the two of the oldest movie studios in the country. Like, it's interesting. It's just, I do think if you wanted to wager on who is going to make things that are more successful, I would put my money on him. But it's very hit and miss. Like
I don't think he is,
you know.
He has more commercial taste. I think he does not have bad instincts. I think it is a fiendishly difficult management situation. That's all there is to it.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that Paramount Skydance is buying Warner Brothers? Peter.
On the one hand, it was going to be sold one way or another. And so the fact that it got sold, not a controversy. On the other hand, Warner Brothers got sold to David Ellison and Paramount. That's pretty controversial. Obviously a controversy.
Alyssa.
The radical reshaping of the industry is always controversial.
It's definitely a controversy. And again, it's a controversy for all the stuff we didn't even get into, which is the regulatory stuff, which bad. Shouldn't have happened. All right. Please swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for our bonus episode about fan fiction, which I have argued on this show is destroying society. Why are we talking about it? That's a great question. Peter's going to tell us all about it on the bonus episode. Now on to the main event.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Scream 7. Gonna be some spoiler talk here. So if you have not seen the movie yet and you really want to see the movie, you don't want to miss out, turn us off now, because we're gonna be talking about things that happen in Scream 7. Don't want to be spoiled. Okay. All right. So we'll still be here when you come back. Sydney Prescott is also back. She's back, baby. Though now she goes by Sydney Evans, and she has married the hunky town sheriff, who's played by the hunky Joel McHale. After the trademark cold open, in which someone wearing a Scream mask kills a pair of people staying at Sydney Prescott's house, I believe, from the original script, Peter, I actually had to ask, I wanted to ask you this. Is that Sydney Prescott's original house, or is it like a house that was built to look like Sydney Prescott's house?
Yes, one of those for sure.
I honestly wasn't sure, because it looked like it was not in the place where Sidney Prescott's house was, which I assume it wasn't. Anyway, it's funny to go back and watch Scream 1 now.
It's weirdly set in a field.
It's set in a field. I was like, why is this in a field?
I mean, I recall it being a little bit sort of like feeling it was like it's a little bit on the outskirts of the of town, yeah. But it was weirdly just set in a field surrounded by absolutely nothing.
Maybe I feel like the original was as well. That was anyway. It doesn't matter. This is neither here nor there. These are the nits we're picking. Anyway, as I said, this house is basically an Airbnb where fans of the Stab series, which is the kind of meta movie within the movie that is going on in these films, takes place. Anyway, the action after this shifts to Pine Grove, Indiana, where Sydney and her family now live. Ghostface is back, and he's killing people to try and get Sydney back into the game. But who is he? Is he one of the friends of Sydney's daughter, Tatum, who's played by Isabel May? Maybe Tatum's boyfriend, or the neighbor kid who's obsessed with true crime podcasts. Maybe it's a teacher, like the creepy drama professor with the curlicue mustache played by Jonah from Veep. Maybe it's Joel McHale himself. Who knows? Who can say? The killer's on the loose. As always, the point of the film and figuring out the killer is honestly less important. It's less about the mystery. It's more about the ways in which the film is playing with horror movie tropes. And one thing I did, I enjoyed, but I'm not entirely sure what they were going for here. Kevin Williamson, who wrote and directed this film and wrote the original, was directed by Wes Craven, the original, is doing two different things, right? One, he is critiquing the previous two entries in this film. And Alyssa, we're going to get to you in a second. You haven't seen any of these. In the previous film, there's a character who's played by Melissa Barrera who is basically schizophrenic and starts seeing what I can only describe as a force ghost version of the killer from the first film, Billy Loomis, who like teaches her to kill for good in that movie. Anyway, Williamson kind of riffs on that by teasing the return of Billy's pal, his fellow killer Stu Mocker, who's played by Matthew Lillard, via some digital shenanigans. The second thing Williamson is doing, he's playing with a bunch of stuff from the original film, not just plot beats, though a lot of the plot beats do hit the same, but also musical cues like Red Right Hand and that Moby track that closes the first film also almost closes this film, but then it doesn't close the film. It's weird. He's also borrowing some of the same locations and same types of locations, kills and garages, that sort of thing. It's all kind of half-baked, if I'm being totally honest. It is kind of half-baked, but there is this kind of interesting meta critique about the series devolving into the lack of originality that the first film, which Williamson, again, also wrote, was itself critiquing. I do feel like this series has settled into a pretty solid groove where even the less good entries, and I would say this is in the bottom half of these movies, are still watchably fun and goofy. I know there are folks who really love the previous two entries. They were fine, They were fine. I mean, I liked them. They were fine. This is fine. This movie is fine. This movie actively rejects those two films in some ways. Neve Campbell was notably absent as Prescott in the last film due to a contracts dispute. She got paid this time around, and it paid off. The film just had the biggest opening ever for the series. But it doesn't lean into all that as much as it really could have. I really wanted them to go into the you know, kind of film at war with itself, at war with its fans theme. They didn't feel like doing that. And again, it does feel kind of half-baked, which makes some sense since they had to tear the script up and start all over again after losing director Christopher Landon, after they fired star Melissa Barrera for suggesting on social medias that the Jews control the media. Alyssa, you've never seen a single one of these movies.
Nope.
Did it make any sense to you? Did anything that happened in this movie make any sense to you whatsoever?
I did not understand this movie, and I did not care for it at all. I turned to Peter at one point, and basically just said, like, this is like watching a Mad Lib. I don't understand it. Like, I don't understand how I'm supposed to feel about any of the references. I don't care about any of the characters. I like Matthew Lillard. He seems like a good guy. And the only good thing I have to say about this movie is that I think of all the uses of AI as sort of a villain plot point in movies we've seen over the past couple of years, this is the only one that felt sort of remotely interesting to me at all. But mostly because I worry about some of my older relatives getting scammed by deepfakes, which is, you know, sort of what happens in this movie. No, I didn't connect to this on any level. I mean, if I think my, you know, I don't like slasher movies. I don't like knife violence. I just didn't see the first Scream when it came out, in part because I think it came out during my sort of like pop culture monk in the wilderness period. And in, you know, in there are moments when that sort of total cultural ignorance can be useful because it's a test of whether a movie works as a standalone object. And I can say this one absolutely did not work at all for me. under like nothing about it was the longest 2 hours I spent in a theater in quite some time.
It's very long. It is. All of these movies are 15 minutes too long, except for probably the first one. The first one gets away with being about 2 hours because it's doing some interesting things. Every other movie in the series somehow is between an hour and 50 and an hour 50 and like 2 hours 10.
Yeah.
And every time I'm just like, why is this so? The slasher should be 100 minutes. Like, in and out, do the kills and then go home. Like, it's.
I had ridiculous. A lot of questions about this. Like, I'm sorry, if you spent your entire life stalked by like psycho killers, like, is it responsible to like get married and have a family? Does that just make everyone around you super vulnerable? Why does she have two kids who are just like randomly off at grandma's, right? Like, why have that be a thing at all? If you do have children and like a husband, how do you not like sit them down and discuss this in sort of a candid way or teach your daughter any self-defense? Like, it feels like a movie that's just like an idiot plot, right? Where like the only reason it works is because like people made stupid, bad decisions. It was also just really funny to me that at a certain point in the movie, like Joel McHale is like stabbed a lot and all of the other characters just like forget about him for the next 40 minutes. I mean, I don't know.
He's not integral to the franchise and they know it.
Yeah, but it's just the whole thing.
But he's very specifically a reference to a character from the first one who this also kind of happens to, who gets like shot and then everybody forgets about him. But he survives at the end. He's one of the love interests.
The whole thing just felt like an insult to my intelligence. I did not like it.
I think I do think that this movie would be totally incomprehensible to anyone who has not seen not only the previous entry, but like all of the previous entries. You could have maybe skipped the Hayden Panettiere one. But even that one had the, what's his name? The guy from The Unit,
Michael Chiklis.
No, that's The Shield.
Oh, that's The Shield. I'm sorry.
No, the guy who, I want to say his name is Scott something. It doesn't matter. There's one of the killers. One of the FaceTime killers is I think a character from that Hayden Panettiere one, but maybe I'm wrong. Peter, you have seen them all. You've seen them all, right?
I've seen all of them, though I wouldn't be able to describe all of them necessarily in great detail. I was sitting there thinking, can I remember who the killer was in number four? No, I just remember the sort of meta, like sitting in front of the TV opening sequence and stuff like that. So like I'm definitely not super well versed in every one of the sequels, but I do really like the original.
The original is pretty great. It's kind of a defining film. Yeah. Peter, what did you make of Scream 7?
Well, that's what I was thinking the entire time I was sitting there, was this movie just makes me think about how great the original was and how the original was making fun of horror films and horror franchises that become this. And yes, this movie is still trying to continue in the tradition of being a meta commentary on horror franchises in itself and all of that. But what made the original so great, and beyond that incredible killer crackling opening sequence that just kills. I mean, it's perfect. It's so well shot. It's so tense. It's like funny, terrifying, right? It's just, and then the reveal is also pretty great at the end, right? That sort of the way they've got multiple killers. What made that movie so great was that it was in some ways to horror a little bit like what the original 1977 Star Wars was to fantasy, science fiction genre films, in that what George Lucas was doing in the original Star Wars was just kind of rolling together like every influence that had ever like come into his brain. This was, you know, it's World War II films and Flash Gordon and Akira Kurosawa and Dune and all that stuff. And it was all together. And somehow or another, this movie, you know, made something kind of new, but also synthetic out of all of this old movie stuff. And it was a movie, again, it stood totally on its own, but it also knew everything about every movie that had come before it. And Scream, the first one, was a film that that worked that way, but for horror. And part of the way it was able to work that way, but for horror, is that it was directed by Wes Craven, right? The guy who made Nightmare on Elm Street, 15 years before that movie, before Scream came out, and had been, you know, a crucial part of the kind of horror, the horror franchise filmmaking of the 1980s. And what Scream did was it just sort of saw, it, like Scream had kind of processed and synthesized every one of those movies. And then in addition, it did something else. It understood how fans had come to relate to those movies. It knew that teenagers would go to these horror franchises and treat them a little bit like jokes, but also like they knew what was coming. Right. Like they understood, oh, this now he's going to come out from behind you right here. And it's sort of that gives it a kind of giggly fun. And it's right in these like in some ways kind of quite gross, kind of quite horrific films become silly. And that was part of what was enjoyable about them was you could just see where all of this was going and that, you know, this kill's going to go like this. Oh, these kids are going off to have sex. And it understood this explicitly so that there's that famous sequence where one of the characters delivers a monologue about the rules of horror films. And what Scream figured out how to do was not just roll up and process all of those previous horror films. It figured out how to, for the first time in many, many years, make a horror movie that stayed ahead of its fans, that actually knew what they were thinking. And it was like, no, we've seen all these movies too. And we are going to be one step ahead of you at every moment. We're also going to reflect your own knowingness back to you. Yeah. And it was so clever. And this movie doesn't do that because its only frame of reference is the previous Scream films. And so it reminded me actually in this weird way of The Force Awakens, which is a Star Wars film that has no frame of reference, no influences except other Star Wars films. And there's ways in which Force Awakens is a better movie on its own terms and a bunch of stuff, but like it's this really sort of it becomes this kind of closed universe in which there's absolutely nothing else going on, and all of that cleverness just sort of recedes into a sort of like a sort of shoddy kind of a smug knowingness. And in this case, it's just also kind of a very mediocre film.
Yeah, and look, I think even if I had seen the original Scream, I just would not have resonated to it because I'm really wired not to enjoy grotesque violence and cruelty for sort of for their own sake, right? Like I don't like being in a position sort of morally and aesthetically of sharing the enjoyment of someone who's killing other people for fun. Like, I don't, and I'm not saying that's a moral thing. I just don't find it pleasurable on any level. And
can I,
you know, yeah.
Well, I just want to ask you a question about this, because one of the smartest, I don't know, it's not that smart, but sort of an interesting little tiny grace note in Scream 7 is when they name check Agatha Christie. And the best thing about, or best, one of the great things about the original Scream, and I think even the second and third one, is that they are a functionally Agatha Christie murder mysteries, like in the way that they're structured, right? There's a kind of closed set and a small cast of characters, all of whom has just enough motivation and just enough mystery to them. And you can imagine, I mean, these movies are much gorier, sure. They are much more violent, but they have a lot of shared DNA, even with, I think, the Kenneth Branagh Agatha Christie films, but just with, like, you know, which are about somebody who is killing for money, for love, for whatever, right, for a reason. And sometimes there are multiple victims who kind of stack up over the course of the story. And you like that kind of thing. I understand that there's a kind of bloodiness and a vulgarity to these, but I do wonder what you would make. I'm not going to tell you got to go out and watch the first Scream, but I do think it's sharp, it's smart, it's funny, and the mystery aspect of it is actually really well handled, especially if you're not, especially for the time. Like, it kind of innovates in the way that it, the killer solution is somewhat innovative and something like a new solution to a murder mystery.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you sort of answered the question, right? When you talked about how in Agatha Christie novels, or in Agatha Christie movies, people are generally killing for something else, right? Like, it's money, it's love, it's, you know, it's fear of exposure. And even something like, you know, the John Wick movies, or just like action movies in general, there's sort of a pride in craftsmanship, but there just isn't. There's a difference between that and the kind of sadism in these movies. And, like, I just, maybe that this makes me like a dumb prude, but I just don't enjoy watching like a teenage girl alone and terrified getting gutted on a stage. Like, I can't find the sort of humor or cleverness in that, just personally. It's just me.
Yeah, that's fine. I like, you're not gonna like the first one. You shouldn't watch it. Though I Peter is right that it is very good. But it's very much not for you. So I would recommend skipping it. I will say, what's interesting, it's funny you mentioned The Force Awakens, Peter, because, you know, I don't know if you remember Scream 5, but there was like a whole kind of like toxic fandom angle to that movie. Like, there was a joke, like, fans were mad because the Knives Out guy was directing Stab 8 or something, you know. That was a little subtle nod to the toxic fans of Star Wars. And this is one of the reasons why I actually kind of like this, and one of the reasons why I've been very amused by the insanely vitriolic responses to this movie, which are like, it pokes the very slightest bit of fun at the people who were very into Scream number 5, making fun of that sort of person. And just like, they can't handle it. They can't handle it at all, which, you know, I don't want to get into a meta discussion about the nature of critics and all that, but it is there. I will say, just lastly, that one thing that the first Scream does very well, and it's because it was made by Kevin Williamson, who at the time was he's doing Dawson's Creek. He's making The Faculty. He's making, what else was there? What else was Kevin Williamson doing around this time? Like, all sorts of like teen, like all sorts of like teen centric, you know, stuff. He had a perfect ear for that generation of young person. Like, those movies feel like smarter versions of teenagers, but like still felt like kind of, you know, clever teenagers, like Joss Whedon-y sort of teenagers. This movie, I do not think really captures the modern teenage sensibility at all. It feels off, like modern mom sensibility
at all, right? And like,
yeah,
I sort of feel like if you're going to make this movie and keep having Sydney around, like, this is a movie that should have something to say about like parents and kids, or, and particularly in this movie, like mom culture, right? Because like it ends up being a story about like two neighboring moms, one of whom has sort of a idealized, if twisted, vision of who the other one is supposed to be. And that actually is really rich, weird territory. And I don't think William Sit, like, I don't think, you know, there's no sense of like the mom chat or activities or like the mom's investments in social dynamics at the school in a way that like could have made a sort of sharp and interesting movie that I probably would have been somewhat more engaged by.
To the extent they do that, it's entirely through the action scenes in which the mom is leading her daughter through how to shoot a killer through the wall. And it did seem to me like there was this very ham-handed and also very ineffective attempt to sort of make the mom stuff about, I'm going to transfer my knowledge, you know, about how to handle this insanity, like this life I've inherited, down to my daughter. And also, like, this movie, we're now at number 7, is going to be about me processing my trauma for having, you know, basically had to face a serial killer every 3 to 4 years for 30 years. And it doesn't work, but I do think there is this gesture towards it where they're sort of trying, and but it doesn't come through.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Scream 7? Peter?
Sadly, I didn't love it. I think this is the worst of the series. Thumbs down.
Alyssa?
No, clearly thumbs up. No, thumbs down.
I'm going to give it a thumbs up because I do think it basically works as a Scream movie. And that's all that I'm looking for in this series. It works on its own terms, which is all any film can do, frankly. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21+.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.